Okay, it's June 29th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. And this afternoon I'm speaking with James Cox. Mr. Cox, I was hoping you could start by just talking a little bit about your personal background and your educational background and sort of your road to the University of Montana in Missoula.
Yes, circuitous road. My wife and I were born in Bayonne, New Jersey. We're both 77 years old. We married at an early age. I was drafted right after we were married. I spent 2 years in the Army and during the Korean War, but it was all spent at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, where I wound up as editor of the Army newspaper. I began as a telephone lineman and wound up as the editor of the Army newspaper. And our daughter was born in the Army hospital there. My educational background is mixed. I was part of the Catholic school system for 16 years, and 8 of those years were with the Jesuits in high school and in college. And I received what I think was a good classical education, to the point where I was even allowed to read as one of the two languages for the PhD in Latin. I could still read Latin. Mm-hmm. And I did get an introduction at that time in chemistry that interested me. When I graduated, it was with a bachelor's degree in English, with this secondary interest in science. When I got out of the Army, I had always wanted to come to Montana, probably from reading Western novels. And so we set out in our 1952 Chevrolet with a 6-month-old child and headed for, would you believe, Jordan, Montana. Mm-hmm. They said they had a semester opening in Jordan, Montana as a teacher of English. And so we arrived in Jordan, Montana at 15 degrees below zero, and I was thinking, if on the way up from Miles City, if the car had run out of gas or malfunctioned, we would have frozen to death. Anyway, I stayed at Jordan for just that semester. I found Jordan absolutely fascinating. We had good friends there who were our hosts, and we decided we're going to either have to make the break right away or we're going to be there for the rest of our lives. And at that time, Jordan, Montana had no paved main street. And as you probably recall from reading the recent Missoulian, it was one of the last high schools in the United States with a dormitory. Mm-hmm. The distances were so tremendously great, the kids had to stay in the dormitory. There was an apocryphal tale that half of the population of Garfield County, I was conceived in that dormitory. I don't believe it. It couldn't have been that high. Anyway, we left Jordan, and then I made a beginning of graduate education that summer at MSU, and took some more courses that had to do with school law and school finance and so forth. We then went to Reigate, Montana, which is the golden capital of Golden Valley County, probably about 80 miles north. Can you place it?
No, I can't miles say I've been in
80
Golden
miles
Valley.
Northwest of Billings. We used mm-hmm. to go back and forth for groceries every week. I liked Reigate. His kids were very good, very sharp, and very conscientious, pleasant to deal with farm kids. And I stayed there for 6 years with 1 year break to do a master's degree in, would you believe, physical sciences under the auspices of the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. At that time, there was simply a lot of money in science education, post-Sputnik era. And I had enough science background so that I could do that. And after probably about five academic quarters at Arizona State University, I did the degree in physical teaching of physical sciences. And I went back to Reigate, became superintendent at age, I don't know what it was, age 30 or something, superintendent of schools, and disliked it thoroughly. And then all of a sudden, the faculty at MSU in teacher education asked me to come down there and do a PhD and to be their person in science education. I went down and spent another five semesters there, finished the coursework for the PhD in science education, and was about ready to settle in there when, at that time, the Dean of Education here, Linus Carlton, and the Head of Physics, Rulon Jeppesen, and Head of Chemistry, John Stewart, were looking for someone here in science education. And they called me and asked me if I would be interested, and I said yes, and a week later I began a career here.
What year was that?
1964. Mm-hmm. But those were three really great names. John Stewart died just this past year, Head of Chemistry. Rulon Jeppesen was a fabulous old guy. And Linus Carlton was a distinguished gentleman. Anyway, those were years when, here at the university, if the administrators just arbitrarily could settle on somebody, they just hired them. Was not this process that is so so rigorous and so involved for hiring. When I arrived in 1964, I'm trying to continue the thread of my own education, I had not finished the dissertation. Nevertheless, they were willing to offer me an assistant professorship, which was nice. And then I had 5 years to finish the degree before I came up for promotion again. I did finish the thesis in time. When I arrived in 64, it was a time of great growth on campus. There seemed to be more money and students. Actually, there was no room in the old chemistry department. I was listed as a dual joint appointment in chemistry and in the School of Education. It's the only one on campus, double appointment. And curiously enough, I didn't know the chemists as well as I knew the biologists, because I had spent one summer up at the biological station. That was the summer of 59, where I met Reuben Dieter, who was the old chairman of botany, and Sherm Preece. And when I arrived on campus, they said, "No room in chemistry, come over to botany, we have a place in botany there." So I spent 17 years as professor of chemistry in the botany department. Mm-hmm. And as a result of my location there, I did a number of publications with the botanists, particularly Sherm Preece and Charles Miller, who retired about the same time as I did, and who was a paleobotanist across the hall. And this shows that you proximity is important. Mm-hmm. In terms of what it is that you get involved with. So, go ahead.
You mentioned that, there was this very open, easy hiring process.
Yes.
Still in place at the time. I guess along those lines, talk about some other things that characterized the university at that time that perhaps changed or found unique. I mean, you're coming from a background of Catholic schools, rural Montana, mm-hmm. Secondary school education, the Army. MSU. So mm-hmm. some of the unique things yeah. about the University of Montana.
Yes. Okay, that's a delightful topic for me because I was aware of these strange changes. One difference that was immediately apparent to me when I arrived at Missoula was the difference between MSU at the time and the University of Montana. Down there, it was rather like the military, where there was a kind of a top-down sort of a structure that was in place and assumed to be the proper way of doing business. And I remember, for example, wanting some supplies when I arrived here on campus. When I went to the chairman, I said, I need some of these. Would you give me a okay to get these materials? He said, what? And what do you need? I said, well, paper clips and a staple. That's not my business. Go get them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a little bookstore. We just went and got the stuff. And I also learned very quickly that, at that time at least, it was the early 60s, there was a kind of delightful anarchism about the faculty here. And it seems to me like the president better look out. The assistant professors are in charge here. And the faculty senate was a blast. I mm-hmm. mean, the president, by convention, I guess, had to appear. But he was always ready to get slammed around. And even though everyone seemed to be delighted with Mr. Panzer,
who are some of the people in particular you remember at the time?
Yes.
That fall under that characterization.
Yes. Right. Well, but particularly the characters of the faculty mm-hmm. senate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ones that made the meetings most lively. There was an old boy from the School of Education who was an expert in public school finance, and in fact had himself written up what at that time was the method of distributing funds to the public schools in Montana. His name was Vern Sletten, and he died maybe a couple or 3 years ago. And another was Bob Fields, who was chairman of geology. Another was, what was his name in philosophy? Well, Henry Bugby, who was chairman of philosophy, was very aggressive and very, very vocal and well-spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And John Lowry, who left, I think, about halfway through his career for California. And these people, many of them were, I don't want to say wild, they were just asserting what they felt to be the prerogatives of the faculty in university governance. And this is delightful, I said mm-hmm. to myself, this is the way it should be. And that was the great contrast. It's not true. Down at MSU, I heard later there was a faculty senate, but I think it was some kind of closet organization that met in the middle of the night. were considered, I'm sure, subversive. But that was not the case here. Now, if you want me to continue on that theme, mm-hmm. I'd be delighted. What year would that have been? 74, perhaps? The financing of the university began to come apart, and things began to get very, very tight. And the number of faculty who were being hired went down, and there were were salary caps and all kinds of austerity programs that were taking place. And Dick Bowers, who I think had become president at about that time, instituted a retrenchment program. Well, that was not going to be done by Main Hall. That would be anathema for the faculty. So the faculty decided, well, we're going to do retrenchment ourselves. We're going to see if there's any fat here that can be separated from the bone. And they put together a retrenchment program of five different retrenchment committees, two of them in the humanities, two of them in the sciences, and one in the schools. At that time, the schools really were kind of the tail end of the university, School of Education and the Business School. The Business School has proliferated since. It was nothing like what it is now at that time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they put together those five committees, and I was chairman of one of the ones in the humanities, and the job was to decide where we might make some cuts. And we made very few, I think. We made one in journalism, and we made one in foreign language. And it was when I was chair of that committee that I first met Gerald Fetz. Do you know Jerry?
I don't know.
Yeah, he used to be head of the Department of Foreign Language. He's now the academic dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Okay, and he and I got along well, and he convinced me that the foreign language department ought to be invulnerable on this, because of the fact that we had this giant humanities program. Everyone was required to do a certain number of group requirements in science and group requirement in humanities. Had a beautiful program in humanities, a three-quarter sequence, ancient, medieval, and modern mm-hmm. humanities. And Jerry was telling me when he and I were interviewing with respect to the business of this committee that the background of PhDs in foreign language is exactly right for a humanities program. Because it's not only the language, they study the history and the art and the culture of a particular location, usually European, and they have the package that fits the humanities program. And I was impressed at that, and they got off very easily. Anyway, something else that took place at that time. I had gone on sabbatical. And I was interested in educational television. I spent the year at KTCA, Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is their PBS affiliate, as a kind of sidebar here. I did write a proposal for a national documentary on world water problems, which we then produced over the years, and which apparently was good enough. But when I got back, the union had been invented and had kind of taken over the place. And, I'm politically liberal, come from blue-collar union folks back in New Jersey. But I said to myself, well, that's okay for a shoe factory, but I don't think it's okay for the university. And I think my misgivings have been borne out over the time, because when I got back and saw things begin to change, it seemed like it was all union related. There were quite different assumptions pervasive through the faculty. As soon as you unionize, you say to yourself, we're labor and they're management. Mm-hmm. That is the fundamental postulate of unionization. And what it did then was kind of take the administration off the hook for salaries. Oh, well, we'll get in there, we'll negotiate, everyone said, yeah, right. It also began to lead to a kind of an abandonment of the proposition that a university should be governed by its faculty.
Mm-hmm.
These are educated people, and this is an educational institution. We're not really concerned with bookkeeping. We're concerned principally with education. We need to decide what that is and how we would go about purveying it. And since that time, I think there has been a degeneration in the sense of collegiality. I know there's been a disintegration in the handbook of the university.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the committees now are kind of functionary committees, nothing that has to do with the goals of the university. When we first came to the university, I got dragged kicking and screaming, I think it was because of my joint appointment, into the political scene. I'm not a public guy. Nevertheless, I found it fascinating. The Faculty Senate decided that they needed to formalize the notion that the faculty is the thought behind the university. Joint governance, but particularly faculty governance. And the Budget and Policy Committee, it used to be called, of the Faculty Senate, decided to invent a committee specifically designed to consider and further perceptions of the goals of the university. It was called the Goals Council. I wound up chairman of the Goals Council. And Tom Huff, I don't know, Tom Huff mm-hmm. in philosophy, John Tibbs in zoology. Oh gosh, who all else? Les Russoff from the School of Law, precious guy. And we wrote a whole bunch of white papers
mm-hmm.
about this and that. Les did a wonderful one having to do with university athletics. And Tom Huff did one on teaching. I did one on the importance of the media in education. And Mr. Panzer gave us short shrift. I mean, we've worked on these, we presented these, and I think the one having to do with athletics kind of irked him. He dismissed that out of hand, and it started a kind of adversarial relationship where he simply wasn't paying any attention. And I knew Mr. Panzer very well in that context, and he was absolutely wonderful with respect to the controversies at the end of the 60s there, as everyone will attest. But I would not further his name for sainthood
mm-hmm.
because he did not look ahead. He was a good manager, came from the School of Business, and I didn't feel as if he was visionary. I felt as if he were on the ball, he would have pushed the Rocky Mountain Museum for this campus, because it was here that were the classic collections in paleontology located.
Right.
Over there in the old geology building that was torn down, and our departments of zoology and botany were considerably larger and more able, I think, I can make those comparisons. Also, not only should the Rocky Mountain Museum have been on this campus, but PBS ought to have been on this campus, not down there at Bozeman. And he did not get to jump on that, even though we were telling him that something is coming down the road here that you better be prepared for. And in fact, they had a kind of a pro forma meetings on, well, where are we going to put PBS? But the meetings were organized down there at MSU. They had stolen a march on us. And Patricia Douglas, who at that time was financial vice president, and I were the representatives to the committee to make that decision. I made impassioned plea. I said, PBS belongs here. This is the home of radio and television. This is where the School of Journalism is. This is where the graduate school of education is. This is the campus that has the fine arts. This is where PBS belongs. Didn't get the job done for lack of vision. So,
I want you to talk a little bit more about something you mentioned before, which is the demise of faculty, or degeneration of faculty congeniality, I think is how you put it. And in the context of that, you know, you associated it with unionization. What was the face of that congeniality and how did it change? What did faculty do together on campus, off campus? And maybe also the face of faculty-student relationships as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that the main focus of the congeniality I was talking about was everyone's participation in university governance in the Senate. The Senate was very big at that time. People used to go to the Senate as if they were going to go to some kind of a rock concert. It was just that much fun.
Where was it held?
It was held, different places, mostly in LA 11, a little kind of amphitheater. I used that as a classroom a couple of years, and it was nice. A venue. But also, there are a lot of sociability and interaction among the faculty. Everyone was giving parties and attending parties, and there was a Christmas dinner and an ice sculpture and so forth. Also, there was a lot more participation by faculty in student affairs. This may sound funny, but when I first arrived, fraternity dances, sorority dances, had faculty chaperones, would you believe? Earl Laurie, who wound up as academic vice president, I guess, for a while, and his wife and Cecilia and I were constantly being called as chaperones for sorority dances.
There were still... Is it the Dean of Men and the Dean of Women at the time?
Dean of Men, Dean of Women, yes. And Maureen Clough was the Dean of Women, very, very protective of her brood. And to the point where there were rumors that she wanted to take the cook machines out of the women's dormitory because there was something in the Coke that was turning on these young ladies. Now, I'm sure that's apocryphal, but maybe it was just summoned up to kind of characterize her perspectives on the problem.
That is funny, because Coca-Cola is still, of course, quite an issue on campus
for yes,
far different reasons.
Right, it's the single most pervasive educational issue. The faculty was smaller, and one aspect of it that I thought of at the time that may have been largely responsible too was the competition for money. Up until that time, the university sort of magnanimity, need this faculty member, need this laboratory. Okay, we got it. Or you got it. But then it began to get a little dicey when different departments were competing for a single faculty opening. And when departments began to compete for courses, because they had to have the student credit hours to justify the size of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I was privy to a lot of that unpleasantness since I was living in the Department of Botany, where botany and forestry were competing for bucks. And they were competing for bucks by who is going to teach forest ecology, who is going to teach mycology, which has immediate applications in forestry. And botany was losing some of those fights, and the chairman was being blamed, I think because he wouldn't participate in this low-life kind of competition.
Mm.
But that caused, I think, fragmentation, alienation. But you talk to the guys here now, and they think of it as a job, and very often they're doing wonderful jobs, rather than as a part of a consortium of scholars. Do you know Mike Chesson?
I don't.
He's a professor of, he's one that'd be fun to talk to. Meyer Chesson. he and I play pool every Tuesday. And he's been here since the end of the war,
mm-hmm.
World War II, that is, and heavily involved in campus affairs. 300 University Avenue. But symptomatic of what you're asking me and what I remember, there was an organization on the campus called Sigma Xi. It was the science honorary. Not any particular science, but science, general science honorary. There are societies for zoologists, there are societies for chemists, but this was overall. And it was wonderful. There was also a Montana Academy of Sciences that was very active. I was president at one time of the Montana Academy when it was kind of in its heyday, and there were very nice meetings all over the state, sometimes up at Canada, in cooperation with the Alberta Academy of Science. All that has come apart. And it's come apart because people who are in chemistry don't really give a damn about someone who is involved with identification of plants or whatever. Because there's nothing in it for them. They're no longer interested in sitting back and saying, that's interesting for itself. They don't have the time. They're heavily involved in what is really some wonderful research going on now. So that too was a change of university environment. Mike Chess and I brought him into the conversation because he and I tried desperately to revive or give resuscitation to the Sigma Xi, but the number of people who would attend kept falling off and falling off, and the weekly meetings continue to lose popularity. Mike and I did this in retirement, just as a kind of what we thought was a worthwhile effort, but it didn't work. And both of those organizations, I think, are moribund now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my perspective on changes. You talked about changes that occurred in the student body. A similar kind of attitude, I think, infected the student body. I don't know which was the vector, but the students began to take a very, very pragmatic and commercial view of education. They began to develop the idea that how do I say this? That they were in a supermarket, and this was their sack, and you were to fill the sack, and if somehow they didn't receive your parcel, that was the fault of the purveyor, not the fault of the customer, because the customer, as we know, is always right. And that attitude, I think, really carried the day. From talking with faculty members over the years, they all agree that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the faculty itself began to develop this view of the university as a business, the students began to develop the idea of the university. And if the students did not do well in the examination, that was your fault. You simply didn't succeed in conveying this well enough so that they got the expected A. And that also, I think, may have had to do or be an outgrowth of the student evaluation procedures, which I thought were wonderful. I was here during the David Rorvik era when he was editor of the Kaiman, a wild man, and he was the one who exposed Colonel Angwin. Do you know that story?
No, I don't. Tell
me. It's a good one. There was an old boy, his wife just died recently, by the name of, I should be able to remember his first name, anyways, Colonel Angwin. And Colonel Angwin was raising hell on campus about an English professor. He wasn't an English professor, he was an English instructor, kind of a wild man, who was asking the students to read something called Student as Nigger.
Mm.
Student as Nigger. And there was obscenities in it and so forth. And Colonel Angwin was going to cleanse the university, blew the whistle on Denny Bluen, I think that was him. And everything here on campus was in an uproar for about a week. All of a sudden, David Rorvik, how he managed to do this, I don't know. There was no internet at the time to dial up Colonel Angwin, you know. He learned that Colonel Angwin had propositioned a streetwalker down in Salt Lake City when he was on on one of his convention visits. And David Rorvik even learned the price of the offer, which was very modest. And all this came out of the time. I'm sure that someone has a copy of that time in somewhere.
So the colonel's moral high ground was somewhat diminished.
Right, that's right. He lost that battle with Denny Bluen, and he left the university in disgrace, and the poor wife stayed. How did I get up on that? Oh, that was the same guy who invented faculty evaluation. And his first attempt was very, very crude, but very, very funny. Some of the write-ups for the faculty were classic. But anyway, that was the beginning of a kind of an attitude, I think, of consumerism among the students. That was all big shopping spree. Contributed to that general evolution.
Mm-hmm. So make an assessment of what happened in terms of quality of education here at the university in light of those two changes, faculty, you know, changing in the direction of being more competitive over salaries, you mentioned, somewhat fragmented socially on campus, as well as the students becoming, as you described, more pragmatic, commercial, looking to just pile up the necessary parts of education instead of having
jump over the hoops.
Right. Yeah. Instead of a more holistic view of education. And if you can, assign some indicators of your evaluation. Because at the time, you know, student body's growing by then. After the mid, late 70s, there's growth on the campus in departments as well as enrollment.
Yeah. Well, I've got to believe in summary that both the students and the faculty are better, smarter, better prepared, maybe even more conscientious, hitting the ball harder because of the competitive environment, both in terms of the students' view of their preparation and the faculty awareness of competition for funding. So many of the faculty are simply working very hard on research simply to survive, because the soft money will keep them in touch for 5 years, 8 years. And also, such grants are the stuff of which promotions are made. No research, no publications, no promotions. It's that simple. I read that accurately when I arrived in 1964. I published a lot. I wrote a lot of grants. When I became a full professor, I said to myself, well, I've got nothing to prove here now. I can find money, and I can write in the field successfully. I've done it. But both through the literature, but also television. And I stopped that. I don't need to do this anymore. Now I'm going to do some of the things that I find personally satisfying and personally important, even though they may not be what those who adjudicate grants would want me to do. Mm-hmm. The hell with them. Now I'll do what I choose. But anyway, with respect to your question, all of this competition has made, I think, both students and faculty better. I go to some seminars now, occasionally, on topics of interest to me. And I find them very, very sophisticated. Very sophisticated. And now part of that, I think, may have to do with the availability of the knowledge of the world at your fingertips with the computer. In 1960, everything was mellow, leisurely. The hallowed halls of Ivy kind of image, you know. But people weren't as challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Things were easier. And the students were, I think, themselves kind of at leisure.
Mm-hmm.
As you maybe were, skole, which is the Greek word from which schools derives leisure. And it was leisurely.
Mm-hmm.
It's not leisurely now. Talk to the faculty, they're not very happy. While they're doing wonderfully sophisticated stuff, the environment in which they're doing it seems to me to be more like the shoe factory.
And a result of unionization?
Yes. I'm glad you picked up on that. But yeah. Yeah. I don't blame the union. I'm just saying that these several things that took place beginning in about 74, if I had to give a date to it, co-evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Like some species co-evolved into a kind of ecological niche. Yeah.
So one, I think, common criticism maybe I've heard about that change in faculty and students becoming more sophisticated, to use your words for it, is that they also become far more specific, and that somebody like yourself, who is hired in departments, you know, that are pretty different, chemistry and education,
and
plus
botany.
You really had your hand in botany,
yes.
That's just hardly possible anymore at this size university.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who would arrive now and be offered a joint appointment would be a damn fool to accept.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I could make it work. I could go to two different weekly departmental meetings and carry the torch of one for the other. And and expect that if you did good work, that both would recognize it and that you would receive fair treatment. Yeah. But nowadays I think that would be you'd be suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you still live in Missoula, obviously. Keep up on the university or your peers? And
I swim every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back and forth, I meet this one and that one. And I may have mentioned that Mike Chess and I played pool together. It was a group of six of us.
Mm-hmm.
One guy in American literature, one guy in linguistics, one guy in chess and botany, one guy in biochemistry, and one guy in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lunch at the Mo Club and discuss these kinds of things.
Right. I mean, see, that seems unique in that, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it would be hard to go out on campus and find younger faculty working right now who have that broad of an association with other faculty.
I agree with that. Yeah. Now, this may be taking place, but it probably, if it is taking place, it's probably taking place as a function of where they live, if they're up this canyon or that
mm-hmm.
canyon, you know,
mm-hmm.
rather than as a result of any kind of collegial intercourse here on campus.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I was getting at in terms of you still being very active in the university, or the community of the university, give me an assessment of the university today. Where do you think it's going?
Well, I myself, there's a lot of unhappiness with George Denison, as if he were some kind of tyrant. I don't think of him that way. I think of him as a sharp, sharp guy, very dedicated to the campus. His tenure and mine just overlap very briefly because I retired at age 56.
Mm-hmm.
But the times that I did talk with him, he was a quick study and and incisive. And I think when he arrived, he said, well, there's not going to be a lot of money for academics, but the people who run the university system over there in Helena warm up to topics of roofing and sidewalks and building laboratories and so forth. And so that's what I'll do. And he's done a masterful job of transforming the campus. And George, too, said, well, we're having a hell of a time supporting students with tuition for that reason, but also for the broadening of the university. I want to get some foreign students in here. And he packed the campus with foreign mm-hmm. students, and I've got to believe that was a wonderful idea. Mm-hmm. Because many departments now have sprung up and have embraced aspects of their programs that emphasize overseas ties, and the fellow campuses in New Zealand and in Japan and so forth. I spend a lot of time in Indonesia. I speak Indonesian. And there was a time when, hell, there must have been like 30 Indonesian students here on campus, and a gamelan orchestra, and Indonesian classic dance. That was amazing. You think of Montana as some kind of backwater, you know. It isn't. And that's one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
This attempt to reach out and bring these Saudi students here is just enlightened, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know whether that's the future of the university, but that certainly is George Denison's
right.
view of it, and I thoroughly agree. But as if the issue is growth, I don't think there's going to be a lot of that. I think Montana is pretty much steady state, and if there is to be growth, it's going to be people from the coasts and overseas. And that's all to the good.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'd like you to finish with whatever your last words for this would be, whether it's memories, another good story, assessment of your own time or your own.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Success.
My own involvement.
Mm-hmm.
I've been delighted. I've been delighted ever since I arrived, September the 5th of 1964. I feel as if I've died and gone to heaven here on this campus. Lots of wonderful guys and lots of wonderful conversations. People sincerely interested in doing what they can for our common humanity, and I don't think if I had it to do over again, I would do much that was different. At first, I was reluctant to get involved in anything except my own work, but I'm pleased that I did it now. I was heavily involved there for some time. And strangely enough, in spite of the fact that I was enjoying the work, I was chairman of the Faculty Senate in 81, 82, and I did write some drastic changes in retirement policy that made retirement very attractive. At that time, the union existed, and I didn't get much help from them. It was as if they weren't really interested in retirees, they were interested in the people who weren't retired. And then I worked on getting it done during the legislative session, during the odd year, which would be 1983, and we made it work. So there were a lot of us who were on one-third time contracts for a number of years. And I felt that was a pleasant way to go out,
mm-hmm.
because you could be here for whichever quarter you enjoyed the most. When the courses that you liked best were being offered, you know, you could continue with that. And then for the rest of the year, you could be anywhere else. In fact, I was in Bahrain. I was in Indonesia, as I told you. I was in Thailand and so forth during those parts of the year. That was very pleasant, a very nice way to sign off. So, So that is my peroration.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, nice talk with you. It's nice that you're doing this, because there are going to be a lot of guys who have fun tales to tell.
Yeah, there have been already.
I ought to get to listen to things.
Yeah.